The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler and the Washington Post and, time permitting, AAA Go Magazine. As a reminder, neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the excursions, safaris, trips, what have you, that are featured in our readings. They are selected merely for your enjoyment and edification. And our first destination on today's Armchair Traveler is Tokyo, Japan. Writer Mickey Rapkin tells us about Tokyo, the getaway game. Now, his article is found in the February-March 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Mickey will take us on a three-day tour, with each day broken down into specific time periods. And we're going to set out on day one at 2:47 a.m., so no sleep here. And Rapkin begins this day by labeling it "Too Much Tuna." I arrive early at Tsukiji Market, the largest wholesale fish market in the world. For the high-stakes tuna auction, bidding begins at 5:30 a.m., and only 120 visitors are allowed to watch. Tsukiji attracts about 40,000 shoppers daily, but wasn't designed to be a tourist attraction. Forklifts whiz by in tight alleyways, and one of the fishmongers actually gives us the middle finger, the Japanese equivalent of "I'm walking here." A buyer tells me about the most expensive tuna ever sold, a $1.76 million bluefin auctioned in 2013. At 5:20 a.m., we are ushered into a hangar where licensed buyers examine the fish. The whole thing feels like the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. A bell rings, and men start shouting numbers and barking into cell phones. What jet lag. 6:12 a.m., the raw bar. Compact sushi counters surround Tsukiji. While I wait 30 minutes for a seat at Daiwa Sushi, I get the skinny on Tsukiji's long-delayed move to modern facility, a transition mired in corruption accusations. Once seated, I ask the chef about the impending move as he serves me pieces of sea urchin and skipjack. "Next year," he grunts. "Really," I say. "The safest bet, definitely before the Tokyo Olympics in 2020. 7:53 a.m., take a bath. Full and happy, I check in to Hoshinoya, a modern ryokan, or a Japanese inn, in the center of Tokyo. I change into a kimono, then make my way to the hot spring, fed baths, on the 17th floor. This is a retreat like no other, a dimly lit pool with an open-air skylight, where you can get naked and soaked to the soundtrack of the city. 11:32 a.m., hashtag perfect. The Tokyo train system is a marvel of efficiency and affordability in a city where taxicabs are stupid expensive. I take the Chiyoda line to the Meiji Jingo stop, admiring a businessman with his Samsonite luggage and Hello Kitty cell phone case on the way, and walk over to the Harajuku neighborhood. Once the epicenter of forward-thinking fashion co-opted by Gwen Stefani and others, now the best place for people-watching. Teenagers eat rainbow-colored clouds of cotton candy, and women carry umbrellas to avoid getting a tan. Harajuku's newish trend, cat cafes, for about $10 entrance fee. You get a cup of coffee and 30 minutes playing with adorable kittens that tussle with each other and nap on your lap. Move to the afternoon, and it's 3:15 p.m., and WrestleMania is on the agenda. It's off-season for sumo wrestling, but I luck out. There's an all-day exhibition tournament of the Yokozuna, the grand champions, in an arena in the center of the city, including an appearance by Hakuto Sho, a 32-year-old Mongolian superhero who holds the record for most career wins. When Hakuho first arrived in Tokyo at age 15, he was so small no sumo stable or training facility would take him in. Now he's the greatest of all time. The main rule of sumo seems to be push your competitor out of the ring. The men square off, pulling the tassels around their waist to the side, and then slap their thighs. Actually, I have no idea what's going on. The last match of the day is a nail-biter. As his winning move, Hayuko somehow lifts up his 293-pound opponent and drops him outside the ring like a rag doll. 5:23 p.m., quitting time. I follow the Japanese salarymen to Omaide Yokosho, nicknamed Piss Alley, a series of narrow, winding alleyways lined with yokotari joints outside the train tracks in Shinjuku. I pick a spot that looks the most fun, sliding open a glass door to a chan, which has 15 seats and as many people smoking. The bartender flips the menu over to the English side, which promises for 1,650 yen, or about $15, six kinds of Japanese skewered pork and beer set featuring giblets, innards, and organ meat, etc. I'm alarmed by the use of etc., but each stick is spiced to perfection. 10:30 p.m., Kanpai. That's Japanese for cheers. Here's another phrase I learned, Nomakai, which is a uniquely Japanese phrase that basically translates to forced fun or team drinking. If the boss takes the office out for drinks, you can't go home until he does. For Nomakai, there's no better experience than the Golden Guy, a series of six snug Shinjuku alleyways packed with more than 200 Barbie-sized bars, four stool watering holes, including maybe the world's smallest karaoke bar. From an architectural standpoint, it's a time capsule view of old Tokyo. It's also bonkers fun, as at a locals only place once called Okutai, the bartender charges me a $10 cover. I don't blame her. Everyone is trying to keep the Golden Guy real. Now we move to day two, and it's titled Real Talk, and it's 8:23 a.m. As I'm exiting the train station, an elderly Japanese man carrying a large satchel shuffles by, smiles at me, and says loudly, "I love you." He lets out a belly laugh and shuffles away. I have to pause to catch my breath. I flew to Tokyo from my home in L.A. on the one-year anniversary of my father's death. On paper, my dad and I didn't have much in common. He was a gym teacher who liked routine. He ate pasta practically every night for dinner. He hated traveling. I'm a gay travel writer who just ate raw fish for breakfast again. Whenever I was away on assignment, I'd call to tell him about some surprising thing I'd seen. All I wanted this morning, every morning, was to be able to call him. I'm not saying this old Japanese guy was some celestial incarnation of my dad or anything. Probably he spotted a hopeless white guy and decided to practice the only three words he knew in English. But still, well, it's 9:55 a.m. Ready? Player one. The Japanese word otaku means fanatic, or rather obsession, to the point that you can't see how it's ruining your social skills. Everyone in Tokyo seems to be a video game otaku in Akihabara, or Electric Town, with its seven-story arcades and used electronic stores. I visit Club Sega to play a virtual reality game called Mortal Blitz, which is the best $15 I've ever spent. You put on a backpack and VR gloves and walk to your starting position on the arcade floor. Pick up your rifle, put on the VR goggles, and bam! You're standing on a spaceship battling winged aliens. How real does it feel? At one point, staring down into a digital abyss, I had to take the glasses off so I didn't puke. Ooh. At 10:46 a.m., there's a quick note here. Beneath every building seems to be a shopping mall and food court. Obviously, as he's walking, he catches that particular observation. And then we move on. By 11:12, it's Toy Story. When I was 12, we had a garage sale where, against my father's wishes, I sold my favorite toy for $15. It was a hefty metal robot called Voltron that starred in a Japanese cartoon I watched dubbed in English. I spent an hour roaming Akihabara's manga toy stores looking for my Voltron in his birthplace. Very rare, one shopkeeper tells me, directing me to the multi-story vintage toy shop, Mandraka, where, between rows of ancient Godzilla toys and Hot Wheels, I find an original Voltron set from the 80s still sealed in its box for $400. My dad was pissed that I'd sold Voltron, but he'd turn over in his grave if I'd paid $400 to get it back. Not when I could meet a real robot at 3:15 p.m., Robots Rising, Tokyo's National Museum of Emerging Science and Innovation, where Honda's Asamo demonstrates its talents four times daily. The 4'3" robot runs into the pavilion at full speed. He waves to the crowd, which is frankly the creepiest thing I've ever seen, until he flat out kicks a soccer ball. Robots may change your life, says the announcer, which is what I'm afraid of. I ask one of the museum's resident nerds, Matt Escobar, Ph.D., when will the robots take over? He doesn't laugh. Hopefully never, but I think in 20 or 30 years they will be very smart. 6:30, 2 p.m., Cocktail Culture. Star Bar and High Five are both killer temples of mixology, but I'm partial to Jin Yamamoto, which is the name for both the bartender and his 8-seat, one-room space where he mixes up sake and soju cocktails with seasonal ingredients picked daily at the market. For one drink, muddled fresh tomatoes mixed with Japanese Nikka coffee gin, local citrus, and peppercorns. It's maybe the most delightful summer sip I've ever had. Now it's midnight. Yes, that bar. Sofia Coppola's Lost in Translation is a perfect movie about a special kind of loneliness one experiences in Tokyo, a gorgeous anonymity in a city where people are stacked on top of each other. In the film, Scarlett Johansson follows her photographer husband to Tokyo, and while he's busy working, she wanders around town, ultimately meeting Bill Murray at the New York bar on the 52nd floor of the Park Hyatt Hotel, which is where I go tonight. Looking out the window at the insane views of Tokyo's endless skyscape, I also spy a dozen tourists glued to their iPhones, which makes the film even more of a perfect time capsule. Would Scarlett's character have met Bill if she'd soothed her loneliness with an iPhone? Brings us to day three, and this one says, use your noodle, and we start at 10:30 a.m. Brian McDuxton left his Bay Area tech job to teach English in Tokyo, but 10 years later, his one-year adventure threatens to become something more permanent, now that his blog, Ramen Adventures, has turned into a local institution. Real ramen nerds eat 600 bowls a year, he tells me. He eats 300. But the dude's legit. He once hosted his own local TV show where he and the woman of AKB48, basically Japan's Spice Girls, would go around town tasting ramen. The concierge at the Palace Hotel, a contemporary retreat with impressive views of the Imperial Palace Gardens, arranges a tour for me with Brian, and we set out to hunt ramen. We hit Ginza noodles for the triple ramen, which refers to three broths, dashi, chicken, and clam, plus some aromatic oils. With good ramen, Brian explains, you should experience salt right off the bat, then a smooth umami aftertaste. At Kikinbo, recommended by Noma chef Rene Redzepi, droplets of pork back fat float in a spicy broth. A woman next to me orders the devil spice ramen, made with Trinidadian scorpion peppers and served in a black bowl, but barely breaks a sweat. Well, it's 12:58, charmed. Entering Meiji Shrine is like walking into Tokyo's natural air conditioning. The city is steamy in the summer, but a canopy of camphor trees covers the park-like entrance. Offering cool shade, a girl sells prayer charms, and they're very specific. A charm for traffic safety, a charm for passing an entrance examination, which would have made my dad laugh. I may have run away from memories, but I see him everywhere. 4:11 p.m., retreat. Overstimulation can be a problem in Tokyo, so I spend most of the day being quiet, trying to listen to my own heartbeat. Tokyo may be a concrete jungle, but there's some tropical... Some tropical, there's a little bit of a blurb here. Let's see here. Here we go. But there's some tropical scenery. There we go. The page had curled there for some reason. If you know where to look, next to Meiji Shrine is Yoyogi Park. Even more peaceful is the garden at the Netsu Museum, designed by Kengo Kuma, the architect behind Tokyo's new Olympic Stadium. Netsu Museum, rather, houses pre-modern Japanese and East Asian art, including priceless Buddhist statues. But the garden's the thing. It's like you fall asleep next to a bonsai tree and woke up in an enchanted forest. I inhale deeply and smell something sweet, a mosquito coil, my guide says, laughing, to kill bugs. Everything is beautiful. We move on to the evening, 6:13 p.m., language lessons. English isn't widely spoken in Tokyo, and I don't speak Japanese, so I've made to do with a lot of sign language, which connects you to people in a deeper, often hilarious way. I'm dripping in sweat while riding the train back to the hotel when I notice a woman, probably in her mid-50s, wiping her brow with a handkerchief before handing the rag to her daughter. The mother and I make eye contact, and I mime dabbing my forehead as if to say, me next? She laughs. Well, it's 8:29 p.m., the secret sauce. For a decade, Chef Harutaka Takahashi apprenticed under famed sushi chef Hiro Ono, of the acclaimed documentary film Hero Dreams of Sushi, before opening his own Michelin-starred spot, Hirataka in Ginza. Like so many of the best things in Tokyo, you have to know where to look. Hirataka hides on the sixth floor of a nondescript office building. The elevator opens on a brightly lit sushi bar with 10 seats. Guests are instructed not to wear perfume. Plates start arriving almost immediately after dinner. Diners, whether are seated, conger eel or toro, super fatty tuna, tobiko or roe, and we watch the chef's number two slice a delicate fish with a sword. I ask Chef Takahashi, what's the secret to his sushi? He hunts for the fish himself, he explains, emphasizing the need for the highest quality from Tsukiji Market. But the real secret, he says, is the vinegar and the rice. At 11:32 p.m., it's the heart of vinyl. Running out of steam but not wanting to go to bed, I hop a cab to Hip Ibisu. As the streetlights pass by, I think of Haruki Murakami's novel, After Dark, and this great line about Tokyo at night. Time moves in its own special way in the middle of the night. You can't fight it. I visit a different kind of shrine, Bar Martha, one of the string of vinyl music bars popping up in Tokyo. The joint is easy to miss. Blank cinder block wall and a sign marked bar are the only indication something is happening here. But step inside, and you'll find thousands of LPs, beautifully shelved, and a chill DJ spinning records on a Sirius stereo system. No photos, no requests, and no worries, just top-shelf Japanese whiskey, and Joni Mitchell reminding me that, yes, California, I'm coming home. We can escape from the everyday for so long. Wow. Accompanying Mickey Rapkin's article are a couple of pages of tips of what to see and where to eat when you visit Tokyo, and we're going to feature these recommendations in our next episode of Armchair Traveler as we continue to take a look at Tokyo. Now we're going to continue our journey today by returning to the USA and one of its best-known cities. And when you think of New York City, you should also think of the five boroughs, Brooklyn, Bronx, Long Island, Manhattan, and Queens. In the February 15th, 2018 issue of the Washington Post, travel author and District of Columbia resident Deborah Bruno shares her experiences in visiting one of the boroughs in her article, In Brooklyn, Bridging the Gap Between New Discoveries and Old Favorites. Our daughter Joanna moved to Brooklyn a few years ago. To former New Yorkers of a certain generation, Brooklyn is tinsel on the outdoor Christmas trees, Chinese restaurants lighted by fluorescent bulbs, and fourth-floor walk-ups with worn parquet flooring. It's the place generations of immigrants escaped, first to Queens, then to Long Island, and maybe even eventually to terrain outside of the range of decent pizza and pastrami. Old-school Brooklyn is still there, but there's another Brooklyn, too, and we wanted to know it better. Our usual trips to New York were Manhattan-centric, with Broadway shows, museums, restaurants, and shopping. I mean, why go to Brooklyn? Well, salted cracked caramel ice cream at Brooklyn's Ample Hills Creamery, for one thing. On the first day of our first time visiting Brooklyn 2.0, our daughter insisted we celebrate with a sugar rush. The line for ice cream at the Gowanus store stretches out the door. Inside, it winds around the central counter, where employees rush to scoop ice cream into tall waffle cones and offer up samples, as many as you want, of flavors like Nona D's oatmeal lace, peppermint patty, and butter pecan brittle. There are people I know, and a him I'm married to, who have no shame in trying a half dozen flavors before picking one or two. I succumbed to crack caramel, and it is as good as I'd hoped. A blend of butterscotch, sweet and salty, and a creamy, crunchy party is in my mouth. If I get back before the end of March, I'm tempted to go to the dark side and order ice cream inspired by the Star Wars series. First order, the Stormtrooper Bad Guys, is salted dark chocolate ice cream made with cocoa powder, bittersweet chocolate, and some espresso. Inscribed on the walls of the shop are the words from the Walt Whitman poem, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, which inspired the store's name. What is it, then, between us? What is the count of the scores or hundreds of years between us? Whatever it is, it avails not. Distance avails not, and place avails not. I, too, lived. Brooklyn of Ample Hills was mine. We take our cones and cups and head to the roof of the store, where Adirondack chairs and picnic tables are arrayed. We look over the landscape of Gowanus, the neighborhood possibly best known for the toxic canal that was both a Superfund site and allegedly the place where the mafia dumped bodies. No matter, today I'm commuting with the BART of Brooklyn, and the canal is in the midst of a $500 million cleanup. I like to think that Whitman would have enjoyed both industrial Gowanus, its casket companies, lumber yards, and auto body shops, and the newer version that includes comedy clubs like Littlefield NYC, which is also on our agenda. The club is situated in a former warehouse, of course, and to get a seat for the evening's entertainment, you need to get there early. To stay close, we grab a delicious dinner at Little Neck, a seafood restaurant not far from the club. Our meal of fried clams, lobster rolls, and Old Bay seasoned fries reminds us in Brooklyn we're really not far from the ocean. Littlefield is the kind of place that hosts Punderdome, an evening all about making puns, an erotic live reading of Star Wars, and rising comedians like Aparna Nacharla and a regular performer in a Monday night stand-up comedy set. On the day we show up, the lineup of comedians introduced by comic Wyatt Senek are only moderately funny, but that also might be because we lingered too long over lobster rolls and were forced to stand on the edge of the room for a couple of hours. With the ocean still in mind, the next day we decide to be a little less hip. Okay, way less hip. We head to Coney Island, Brooklyn's summer playland. It's a beautiful day, and we wander along the honky-tonk boardwalk, taking in sunbathers, kite flyers, and amusement park riders. I adore roller coasters, especially the classic Slycone, built in 1927, one of the most famous and longest-running roller coasters in the world. I persuade my husband, daughter, and daughter's boyfriend to take a spin. We wait in a slower line that lets us sit in the first car. I mean, if you're going to do this thing, really, really do it. The ride's 110 seconds are rickety and screamingly fun, even though I wondered if my earrings would fly off my head or my vertebrae might compress me a few inches. For the record, one of us raises her arms at the last dip. There are cameras. One has proof. Although our stomachs are still unsettled, we peek into the original Nathan's Famous. The hot dog place celebrated its 100th anniversary in 2016. Be warned, indulging in a chili cheese dog with beer-battered onion rings and old-fashioned lemonade before the roller coaster might lead to unfortunate results. We cap off our Brooklyn tradition-thon by swinging back to the borough's gorgeous Brooklyn Bridge. The popularity of the 1883 bridge's bike and pedestrian lanes, in 2017 an average of 13,196 pedestrians a day on weekdays and 32,453 on weekends, has led to some calls for restrictions, or at least some more of a separation between bike and pedestrian lanes. Even with the crowds on a sunny day, it's worth to look over the sparkling East River and Manhattan skyline and read plaques that describe how as many as 600 laborers at once put together what was the world's first steel wire suspension bridge. The next day, we opt for something more highbrow. The best place to start is at Jolie Cantina, a French-Mexican fusion restaurant that serves a brunch of Mexican coffee and fresh churros, crepes, chorizo benedict, and brioche French toast. We debate venturing out to do a little climbing at Brooklyn Boulders, the indoor climbing gym in Carroll Gardens, but decide that all those churros are weighing us down. Instead, we head to the Brooklyn Museum. From the outside, the museum has that neoclassical look that you expect from museums, but inside is some of the most groundbreaking art in the city, including Judy Chicago's iconic The Dinner Party, the 1970s feminist work that sets a place for 39 notable historic women, including Emily Dickinson, Sojourner Truth, and Georgia O'Keeffe, using plates modeled after an intimate part of the female anatomy. And until early March, the museum will display Untitled, an 1892 painting by Brooklyn-born Jean-Michel Basquiat that recently sold for an unprecedented $110.5 million at auction. The museum is also on the edge of New York's best parks. Prospect Park has miles of trails for walking, biking, or inland skating, and benches everywhere that overlook ponds and green fields. As of this journey, the park is completely car-free. The Brooklyn Botanic Garden, the Prospect Park Zoo, and a 1912 carousel, which will open March 12th, are all inside the park. In the summer, people flock to Prospect Park on weekends for free concerts. During our visit, we randomly followed its pathways, which means that we find ourselves on the southwest corner of the park instead of the north, and we wanted to get to the Brooklyn Museum and the Brooklyn Library, but that just means more of an appetite for the next meal. The only problem with dining in Brooklyn is that the wealth of choices can be a little intimidating. We opt for a spot that is delicious, multicultural, and offers stunning views. Celestine, in the Dumbo neighborhood. Now, Dumbo stands for Down Under the Manhattan Bridge Overpass. When we tear ourselves away from the windows that open up to the Manhattan skyline, we tear into a Mediterranean menu and make a meal of the mezze and starters. Hummus with sumac and pickled vegetables, baba ghanoush, and house-made yogurt, roasted cauliflower, and Moroccan bone marrow dumplings. As we eat, a violent rainstorm sweeps in, and while we are glad we aren't sitting right next to the floor-to-ceiling windows, it's a little extra entertainment for no extra cost. We also feel as though, despite having not becoming hipsters, we've had plenty of good sampling of whatever changing Brooklyn is all about. And they do have a little travel tip accompanying their article, and what this says basically is... the recommended place is the New York Marriott at the Brooklyn Bridge, so you can be right there at the bridge. This is at 333 Adams Street, and online they have a kind of a weird website. It goes very long. I'll read it one time this way, marriott.com/hotels/travel/nyc/bk-new-york-marriott-at-the-brooklyn-bridge/. Basically, just go to Marriott.com, hotels, travel, and then go from there. I'm sure there'll be a little menu for you to check. And recently renovated, this Marriott offers some rooms with views of Manhattan and the Brooklyn Bridge. The lobby bar and breakfast cafe specialize in local treats like coffee from Brooklyn Roasting Company. And rooms start from $352 a day. Well, in our remaining time, let's say we turn to the events calendar in the March-April 2018 issue of AAA Go Magazine, see what's going on. And let's see, this past weekend we had the Myrtle Beach Stamp and Postcard Show at the Clarion Hotel and Conference Center in Myrtle Beach. There were stamps, postcards, prizes, and free stamps to children who attend. It was all free. Coming up on March 13th through the 17th, it's Charleston Fashion Week. That's at Marion Square in Charleston, South Carolina. Dazzling fashion from top boutiques, emerging designers, and hot fashion designers. And there is a fee involved with this particular event. Check it out at Charleston Fashion Week, all one word, charlestonfashionweek.com. On March 16th, the Women's Women's Woodwind Ensemble, Christ United Methodist Church in Greensboro, North Carolina. Ensemble of professors from UNC Greensboro and Duke are going to perform. There is a fee involved, and you can check it out at musicforagreatspace.org. Musicforagreatspace.org. On March 16th and 18th, the Cape Fear Wildlife Expo at the Crown Arena in Fayetteville, North Carolina. 3 days of family fun, hunting and fishing, exhibitors, wildlife art, decoys, demos, and a whole lot more. It's all with a fee, of course, and you can check it out online at CapeFearWildlifeExpo.com. That's CapeFearWildlifeExpo.com. And that's going to bring us to an end of another episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, the content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.